ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
China arrests a cop and accuses him of corruption, kicks a journalist out of Hong Kong, and America responds. It is China Day on Foreign Edition, the podcast of foreign affairs from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I am Joseph Sternberg, coming to you from our luxury podcasting studio on the banks of the River Thames in London, while Mary Kissel is still away. But I am joined on the line to talk all things China and Chinese influence today with my colleague Hugo Rustall, joining us from his accustomed, secure, undisclosed location in Asia. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Joe.
Well, and we are going to spend our entire podcast today in your part of the world, talking about a bunch of Chinese stories that have been hitting the headlines over the past few days. As I mentioned when we were just starting a minute ago, we've got a very high-profile and very strange case unfolding as a gentleman named Meng Hongwei, who has been the chief of Interpol, the global police cooperation agency based in France, disappears for, about a week, I think, maybe a bit more, resurfaces having sent an alarming text message to his wife, resurfaces in the custody of the Chinese government in Beijing, accused of corruption. And at the same time, we've got a journalist from the Financial Times, Victor Mallet, getting his visa for Hong Kong revoked for hosting an event at the Foreign Correspondents Club in that city that really ticked off the Chinese authorities because it was dealing with the political situation in Hong Kong. So, Hugo, I mean, maybe you can talk us through these two stories. It seems to me that the big theme here is Beijing really being prepared to flex its muscles, even when it knows that doing so is going to call a lot of unwelcome global attention to itself.
Right. So in the case of Meng Hongwei, what seems to have happened is that he was arrested while he was at home visiting China and accused of corruption, but he just disappeared into the maw of party discipline system, which is notoriously opaque. He sent a text message after he landed in Beijing, as you alluded to, with a picture of a knife and saying, "Wait for my call," suggesting that he had been perhaps knifed in the back or was facing the knife. And, it's a reminder that China's justice system does not adhere to the rule of law and is an extremely crude system for dealing with corruption. I mean, it's not uncommon for party officials, even relatively high party officials, to suffer various forms of torture, including deprivation of sleep and shackling in uncomfortable positions. So that is a signal sent both to the international community that Chinese officials will be rolled up even when it causes great embarrassment to the Chinese government. And it sends a message, I think, to the domestic audience also that there is no escape if you're a corrupt official. The Chinese government will come after you no matter what.
I think that the thing that bears focusing on here is actually the international angle of this, because Mr. Meng wasn't just any Chinese official. He was also a Chinese national who was a very senior official at the top of a fairly high-profile global group. I think that most people have heard of Interpol at one time or another. It is crucially important for a lot of global law enforcement activities because it is an informational clearinghouse for the police around the world, trying to track crime across borders. And, that angle is the thing that really jumps out at me here because, the mere fact that the regime in Beijing would somehow disappear a high-profile person actually is not as unusual as listeners might think it is. In fact, we've just before this had a case of a famous actress who hadn't been seen in public for a considerable amount of time and then suddenly emerges accused of various tax infractions. So, this phenomenon of disappearances, even in the 21st century, isn't that unusual. I think what is unusual here is this element of thumbing the nose at the international community and is saying, you know, even if this person is somehow integrated into these global institutions, you know, in which the world's democracies also play an important role, you know, the U.S., Western Europe, you know, the Beijing will still do what it wants to do.
Right. It was quite a coup for China to install its guy at the top of Interpol as president, even though that position doesn't come with day-to-day responsibility for putting out or what's known as red notices for fugitives. It was quite a feather in their cap. And so it does send a considerable message that China is not going to necessarily observe the niceties of international law when their political exigencies are more important to them. It's perhaps analogous also to the sudden disappearance of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the embassy in Istanbul. Saudi Arabia is another autocratic government which just is sending the message that it doesn't care what the international community thinks. Could also compare it to the assassination attempt in Salisbury by the Russian military intelligence of a Russian ex-spy. You know, that was clearly, given the poison that they used, going to be traced back to Russia, but Putin obviously cared much more about exacting revenge on a traitor than how the West would react.
I think that touches on such an important point in all of this because, you know, going back again to Meng Hongwei and the Interpol story, but also, you know, this shows up in a bunch of these other examples. There's been this long attempt over the past 10, 15, 20 years to try to better integrate some of these regimes into the global system. And I think that the hope was somehow that, you know, the democratic norms might start rubbing off, or that, you know, this process of forcing greater open, or encouraging greater openness to the outside world would lead to, you know, useful political changes. This was particularly a theory in the case of China. And yet we're discovering that that actually isn't true, that a lot of the old habits die hard, and that when, you know, Beijing feels that it has various interests at stake, whatever those interests might be in the case of Meng Hongwei, it's not clear that we even know what Beijing thinks is important about this case yet. You know, Beijing will serve its own interests first, even if that comes into conflict with whatever progress, you know, other people have thought that they were making in encouraging that regime to abide by some more global norms.
Right. There's a tendency now towards self-confidence edging into triumphalism and arrogance in China. And you see that in the Victor Malik case in Hong Kong. Also, you know, Hong Kong has never denied visas to journalists on political grounds before. That's something that's only happened on the mainland. And so it's a major event in the territory. And it infringes both on freedom of speech and on freedom of the press, because this event allowing an activist to speak was held at a time when, you know, his party was still legal, although the government was talking about making it illegal. And so tantrum that the Chinese government threw that the Foreign Correspondents Club was giving this young man a platform for his views really goes against the values of Hong Kong, not to mention really the rule of law of Hong Kong. So they don't mind undermining Hong Kong's autonomy and reputation, even though that will have serious repercussions over time for the people of Hong Kong, the economy of Hong Kong.
Yeah, I think that we need to flesh out for listeners a bit more some of the specifics of this Victor Malik case that we've been talking about, because it really is you know, a shocking intrusion by Beijing into Hong Kong affairs. So, of course, Hong Kong, you know, about the size of New York City, former British colony, handed back over to, you know, Beijing's sovereignty in 1997, but on the provision that you would have this one country, two systems administration for at least 50 years after that, so up until 2047, that was supposed to allow a greater degree of political openness in the territory. And in fact, you know, although there are, you know, constraints on the workings of the political system in Hong Kong, you know, it traditionally, until a few years ago, had been much more open. The press had been much freer. Political debate within the territory much more vigorous than anything that was allowed on the mainland. And I think the hope in some places had been that over time, that Hong Kong model would come to serve as an inspiration for political opening in the rest of China. And yet what we have here is, you know, Victor Mallet, a very well-regarded journalist at the Financial Times, has spent many years covering different parts of Asia. He had been posted for that newspaper in Hong Kong. I believe he has had a senior role within the Foreign Correspondents Club, which has been a major social and political institution in the city because the FCC often hosts politically contentious talks. And because he hosted a talk given by a local politician a couple months ago that Beijing really objected to, now Victor Mallet is getting his visa withdrawn. He's going to have to leave the territory, no longer allowed to work there. So, I mean, this is really an assault on the free press. But it's also a real challenge to this notion that somehow, freer parts of China, such as Hong Kong, would become an inspiration to political opening in the rest.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth recalling that just in the last couple of years, several booksellers within Hong Kong were selling books that were politically sensitive, typically bought by mainlanders who traveled to Hong Kong and then taken back onto the mainland. Beijing was upset with these booksellers and kidnapped one of them from within Hong Kong, also abducted one from Thailand, and forced them to make televised confessions and detained them on the mainland. So that also was a big shock within Hong Kong and assault to autonomy and the rule of law. So they're talking now about passing anti-subversion laws in the territory, which are which had been proposed in 2003, but met with such a large backlash from the population. About a million people turned out on the streets to protest, and those laws were shelved. But only temporarily, it seems, there's now a move again to pass those laws, which would make any sort of attack on the Communist Party or call for independence illegal. And basically bring mainland-style law to Hong Kong.
Now, it seems to me that the big unknown that we're starting to face now, both with the Interpol case and with Victor Mallet, the journalist, being pushed out of Hong Kong, is that there is that international connection. However, I mean, first off, because with the Interpol case, it is such a high-profile international group. People are paying attention to this. Mr. Meng's family live in France, which is where the headquarters for Interpol is. So you have a foreign connection there. And there's also a foreign connection in Hong Kong, because the 50 years of the one country, two systems concept was a commitment that the Chinese government in Beijing made to the British as part of the process of negotiating the handover. So it seems to me that there is this really interesting question about, as China becomes more assertive, about exercising its will in some of these cases, how does it bump up against some potentially interested foreign players here? And are some of those foreign parties going to be in a position or have the interest to try to push back on that?
Right. And I think we'll be talking in the next segment about the South China Sea a little bit, where China is challenging global norms and international law to try to change the situation de facto. Control over those waters.
We have been talking China's attempts to expand the enforcement of its rules overseas. And this is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kind of heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon as we look at science, technology, and their influence on our lives. The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. The future is closer than you think. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Joseph Sternberg, and I am in for Mary Kissel, joined again by my colleague on the line, Hugo Rustall, speaking to us from Asia. And as you foreshadowed in our last segment, we are now actually going to turn our attention to Washington, although we are still actually talking about China. because a big foreign policy event that listeners, especially in the U.S., might have missed amidst all of the controversy over the Supreme Court last week was Vice President Mike Pence delivered a major speech to the Hudson Institute, a think tank in Washington, about the Trump administration policy toward China. And I, you know, to start the ball rolling on our discussion of this, I will just come right out and say that this struck me as the sort of speech that I would have wished that President Trump himself would be able to deliver, except that you wonder if Trump would actually be able to get through something like this. It was a very well articulated, you know, carefully reasoned description of the U.S.-China relationship right now and a lot of the challenges in that. You know, looking beyond just a lot of the trade tensions that is in the news right now, to also talk about things in terms of the political and the diplomatic sphere, and you know, basically saying, I mean, my takeaway from this is to say, you know, presidential administrations of both parties in Washington for the past 15 to 20 years have pursued this notion that if you know, the world could induce China to open up to the rest of the world enough economically, the political changes would follow. And I gather my read is that the thrust of the speech is, no, the political change hasn't followed the way that we had hoped that it would domestically in China. And in response to that, and in response to some of the activities that we're seeing overseas from the Chinese government militarily in the South China Sea, in terms of various attempts at political interference in other countries, it's time for a rethink of the China strategy. I mean, if I got that basically right, do you think?
Yes, I think the subtext is engagement has not worked. That doesn't mean we need to totally abandon engagement, but we need to push back on all of these individual things that China is doing to subvert global norms. You know, maybe it's edging towards, I think the Chinese have characterized this speech as engagement with containment. And I think that's probably not a bad summarization. It's not fully containment yet. It's not fully abandoning engagement, but there's a mix there. And some have said that this is the beginning of a new Cold War. I think that's over-egging it. You could say that it's tending in that direction. If China doesn't change its behavior, the U.S. will have to use all of its resources, political, military, economic, to constrain China's behavior.
I mean, one of the things that really jumped out at me as I was looking through the speech again is how comprehensive it is, how it weaves together a story both about the economic engagement between the U.S. and China and, you know, a lot of the problems in that relationship, which don't even necessarily go to the bilateral trade balance. I mean, one of the real services or clarifying elements of the speech, I thought, was that it doesn't talk about, you know, specifically about the trade deficit, although he does mention that. But it has to do more with the general commercial environment, the extent to which American companies are able to trade freely with China, to invest in the Chinese market without interference from the communist government in China. And, you know, I think that that's a helpful way of reorienting some of these economic discussions, because if you're only looking at a very narrow measure like the bilateral trade deficit that the U.S. has with China, you are going to miss a lot of the aspects of this commercial relationship involving intellectual property, involving things like cultural goods. He mentions the extent to which Hollywood now feels that it has to self-censor itself in order to sell, you know, distribute movies in China. You know, if you're only focusing on that bilateral deficit, you are missing all of these elements that arguably are far more important to American companies and American workers.
Right. There's a sense, I think, among the business community, which used to be China's biggest friend in Washington, that China, you know, was welcoming to them when it needed them. But now it feels that it no longer needs them, and they don't get a fair shake in arbitration or regulation. They're harassed by inspections and other regulatory actions. And basically, they're always on the back foot in trying to compete within China. And there was a very revealing story that was published by Bloomberg the same day as the Pence speech about Chinese spies installing extremely small integrated circuits chips onto the motherboards of servers that were being exported from China to Apple, Amazon, and other customers for cloud services. And basically, these little chips hidden on the board created a backdoor for Chinese spies to then download the secrets of companies that were using those cloud services. So the American authorities believe that nearly 30 companies had their data siphoned off in this way. And it's really a quite audacious operation, in part because it throws into question the security of the entire supply chain. Anytime any sort of tech good goes through a Chinese company now, there has to be a question of whether the spies are installing something on it. And that I think that's probably self-defeating for China, because you know, a lot of these supply chains now will have to be reoriented to exclude China if these products are going to be used for any sort of sensitive applications.
Now, the other notable aspect of the Pence speech, though, is that it moves also beyond, I mean, all of these very important economic concerns. I think we're starting to filter into public awareness. And it also looks a lot at the political aspect of all of this, because, you know, it hasn't just been Chinese attempts at high-tech espionage or industrial espionage or forced technology transfers into China. But the vice president is also talking about is presented as a fairly comprehensive influence effort by the Chinese government to try to, partly use its own financial resources as a form of influence in the ways that it, loans money to other countries, particularly in the developing world. Those loans often have various political strings attached to them. But also, the extent to which China has been trying to use various cultural, academic exchanges as forms of, trying to broaden the influence. And, it's not just about the sort of public diplomacy that any government would engage in, but, what Pence and others are talking about here is a very concerted effort to really shape or intimidate your various scholars or students in terms of what they write about China, to make sure that there is less deviation from the established Communist Party interpretation of various events.
And I think what I'm hearing is that the U.S. has discovered China is conducting United Front operations at the Department of the Communist Party that conducts these kind of things. It's similar to what it did in Australia, and that caused a big backlash in the last couple of years. And the Australian government amended its political contribution laws and generally tightened up the controls over foreign people working as foreign agents. But what the Australians discovered is that the Chinese effort was, in their words, covert, coercive, and corrupt. That is, totally non-transparent. They tried to coerce overseas Chinese to espouse the pro-China line. So if what I'm hearing proves to be true and there are cases that come to light, there could be a very major backlash, I think, within the U.S. political system against China.
Well, and that political angle is so interesting in all of this, because, of course, Washington has been consumed for about 2 years now with this Russian meddling narrative, which is a combination of the reality that it does appear that Russia was trying to meddle in U.S. politics or the electoral process in various ways, coupled with a much more of a stretch, this theory that somehow there was collusion between the Kremlin and elements of Donald Trump's campaign for president in 2016. What seems to be opening up here is sort of a new front in this foreign influence battle. We're suddenly now we are focusing on China. And in some ways, what little we can see in public of it now, the Chinese effort seems to be a lot more sophisticated and potentially more damaging than the kind of activity that we saw from Russia. I mean, my general impression is that the Russians are keen to use misinformation and you know, various online disinformation tools, mainly to try to sow confusion within the political system and distrust. Whereas so far, we may be seeing hints that the Chinese are actually being much more strategic in terms of trying to shape public opinion in particular electoral districts or states where they think that it can be most helpful to them.
Right. The evidence that Trump and Pence have presented so far is not terribly convincing. Some of the things they're citing are fairly normal behavior by any government, which is sort of paying to put their message out in the public sphere. It is transparent. It's not corrupt. But there are hints in what Pence said that there's a more sinister kind of influence operation also taking place. So I'm waiting to see the evidence. But I think you're right that it could be this kind of operation can be much more effective in advancing national interest than Russia's approach, which, as you say, tends to be just a kind of a wrecking operation just to create confusion and distrust and undermine faith in democracy.
Well, we are going to have to add these to the long list of stories that we are following week by week for listeners on this podcast. But for right now, we are out of time on this Monday morning. So we will leave things there, but I will thank Hugo for joining me. Please follow him on Twitter, at Hugo Restall, all one word. And give me a follow while you're at it. That's at Joseph Sternberg, also all one word. And be sure to follow this podcast wherever you get your audio content. Make sure that you are kept up to date on every edition of Foreign Edition as we track global mayhem, chaos, disorder, week by week. This has been Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.